vigorous in action and broad and sweeping in thought, dominated the conference, according to New York Times reporter Drew Middleton. Eisenhower wrote an admiring Stuart Alsop, has the grandeur and the power, and a curious brand of earnestness as well, which makes him a man remarkably difficult to disbelieve. Ike scored a signal victory in the conference and smashed into smithereens the deeply rooted image of America as inflexible and bent on war. There was one additional benefit of the summit, as the crafty muckraker Drew Pearson reported. Eisenhower was now in a mood as never before to run in 1956. The platform would be peace in our time. 3. Pearson, though, was wrong. The prospect of running for re-election and serving a second term did not appeal much to Eisenhower. For a man in his mid-60s, who had been working hard for 40 years since he left West Point in 1915, it was natural that his thoughts frequently turned to retirement. By 1955, the Eisenhower home in Gettysburg was fully remodeled. It was a beautiful, comfortable place, the perfect expression of Ike and Mamie's tastes. There, Eisenhower felt fully relaxed. He enjoyed country life, inspecting cattle, talking to farmers, practicing on his own putting green, and entertaining small groups of intimate friends. He had served his country well, and he did not hide his resentment toward those who prodded him to stay on the job for another term. In an August 4th news conference, journalists asked him about his plans to run in 1956. Ike dodged, saying his decision would depend upon how world affairs, domestic affairs, and his own health looked in early 1956, when he would make his decision. Without the gift of prophecy, he said, he had no idea which way he would lean. Most observers felt certain he would stay in harness, noting that the president has the vitality of a man of 54 instead of 64. In his private correspondence, though, Eisenhower voiced much deeper concern about the prospect of re-election. To Swede Haslett, he confided that he did think about the question of age. He would turn 65 in October 1955 and would hit 70 in his last year of a second term. No man has ever reached his 70th year in the White House, he pointed out, and wondered if that barrier should be broken. After all, the last person to recognize that a man's mental faculties are fading is the victim himself. He did not want to become one of those men who hang on too long, while thinking that only they could do the job at hand. Yet he confessed he had not had much success in pushing forward an obvious successor. So far, the able younger men he favored had been met with inertia and indifference by the public. In early August, the Eisenhowers were looking forward to a long summer holiday. The Geneva summit had been grueling, and Ike was ready for a break. On August 6th, he left Washington for Gettysburg, and on August 15th flew to Lowry Air Force Base in Denver, eager to spend a month in the outdoors, playing golf and fishing. He and Mamie stayed at the Dowd home with Mamie's mother, a place they had known since they were newlyweds. Although he attended to government business each day for an hour or two, using the offices at Lowry as a command center, Ike knew how to take a vacation. He played golf almost every day at Cherry Hills Country Club, spent hours working at his oil paintings, and met friends for evening card games at a presidential suite in the Brown Palace Hotel in downtown Denver. He spent many days at the Fraser, Colorado ranch of an old pal, Axel Nielsen, where the fishing was especially fruitful. Naturally, he kept abreast of the political developments back in Washington. When Roscoe Drummond of the New York Herald Tribune described senior officials as happily confident that Eisenhower would run again in 1956, Ike shot off a private letter to his brother Milton. I have done my very best to discourage the thought that automatically I shall be the candidate, he fumed. Of course you know exactly what that decision would be, unless extraordinary circumstances would convince me to the contrary. Indeed, Milton steadfastly urged his brother not to run for re-election. His supporters would not listen to any talk of Eisenhower stepping aside after one term. In early September, Republican Party state chairmen met in Washington to discuss the elections of 1956 and declared, according to Reston, that Ike was the answer to everything. If he should refuse to stand for re-election next year, the confusion would be indescribable, these men told Reston. More than that, they openly loved him. He is a symbol of the atmosphere of the time, optimistic, prosperous, escapist, pragmatic, friendly, attentive in moments of crisis, and comparatively inattentive the rest of the time. Reston asserted that Eisenhower's popularity had gone beyond the bounds of reason and had become a national love affair. Who could blame the public for engaging in constant speculation about a second term? For the time being, Ike avoided all the nonsense. He was having too much fun in Colorado. But his vacation was about to come to an abrupt end. On September 23rd, during what was now his seventh week away from sultry, humid Washington, he did a few hours of paperwork and then headed out to the golf course. He played 18 holes with the club pro, then wolfed down a late lunch and returned to the links for 9 more holes. As he finished up his game, he complained to his playing partner that the onions on his lunchtime hamburger had given him indigestion and heartburn, and he called it quits. He returned to the Dowd home for dinner, picked at his food, and turned in early. At 2 in the morning, he awoke with a searing pain in his chest. Mamie, sleeping in an adjoining room, heard him moving about. She took one look at him and called General Howard Snyder, their physician, who was staying a few miles away at Lowry. Snyder, a lifelong Army doctor who had attended both Eisenhower and Mamie since 1945, had seen the president suffer many bouts of painful indigestion. Ike had a chronic problem of an inflamed small intestine known as ileitis, which caused bouts of gastrointestinal distress. Knowing that Eisenhower had complained in the evening about heartburn, Snyder assumed the problem was related to his GI tract and administered morphine to ease his discomfort. In the morning, Snyder told the staff the president was resting from his digestive upset and would not be in the office that day. It was not until 1:15 in the afternoon that Snyder began to fear Ike's illness was more serious. He called Fitzsimmons Hospital, the nearby military facility, and summoned a cardiologist to administer an electrocardiogram to the president. As soon as Snyder saw the results, he knew the president had suffered a coronary thrombosis, which had resulted in an acute massive anterior myocardial infarction. In layman's terms, a blood clot had caused a heart attack. Snyder now ordered Ike to be transferred to Fitzsimmons by the Secret Service. There, doctors gave him a number of anticoagulants and put him in an oxygen tent to ease his breathing. He slept fitfully through the afternoon and night. Saturday, September 24th, was supposed to be a quiet one for the White House staff, and many of the top assistants had taken a vacation to coincide with Eisenhower's Denver trip. The heart attack shattered that calm. Snyder called Press Secretary Jim Haggerty, who was at home in Washington taking a nap after a round of golf at Columbia Country Club. Haggerty called key officials, including Nixon, Foster Dulles, and, because Sherman Adams was in Europe on holiday, Jerry Persons, the Deputy White House Chief of Staff. Persons, in turn, alerted cabinet members to the news. Haggerty's Deputy Press Secretary Murray Snyder, who was with the team in Denver, released a bulletin to the press at 2:30 p.m., announcing that the president had suffered a mild coronary thrombosis. Haggerty hastily arranged to fly to Denver on a military aircraft and brought with him Dr. Thomas Mattingly, the cardiologist at Walter Reed Army Hospital in Washington, who had regularly examined Eisenhower and never detected any heart disease. Haggerty arrived at midnight in Denver and immediately imposed order on the scene, ensuring that the press would be regularly informed of the president's condition. He also effectively squelched what might have become serious criticism of Dr. Snyder for waiting 12 hours before transferring a gravely ill president to the hospital. John Eisenhower arrived from Washington the next morning. "Obviously under sedation," he wrote later. "Dad spoke quietly, You know, he said with an air of wistful detachment, these are things that always happen to other people. You never think of their happening to you. John and Mamie took rooms in the hospital and slept there for the next few days. Mamie held up extremely well, spending most of her time writing replies to the flood of personal cards she was receiving daily from around the world. The nation's leading heart expert, Dr. Paul Dudley White of Massachusetts General Hospital, arrived at Fitzsimmons later that afternoon and lent the authority and credibility of an independent, non-military physician to the team. After consulting with the medical staff and examining the president, White described the heart attack as neither mild nor serious, but moderate, and tried to be reassuring about the president's prognosis. By the afternoon of September 26th, White felt comfortable enough to return to Boston, following a detailed and lucid press conference in which he gave the nation a tutorial on heart disease. He expressed his confidence in the excellent medical care the president was receiving. These words did little to reassure the financial markets, however. When the New York Stock Exchange opened on Monday morning, it suffered its worst one-day loss since the crash of 1929. The traders bet that Eisenhower's time in the White House was coming to an end. 4. In the next few days, the news out of Denver improved. Eisenhower signed a few papers on September 30th in a carefully orchestrated demonstration that he was still competent. On October 2nd, doctors reported that the president had made it halfway through the crucial 2-week period when heart attack patients might develop complications. In this period, only family members, medical staff, and Sherman Adams were allowed to see him. On October 5th, the doctors reported him cheerful and making good progress. Haggerty even detailed the president's diet, which on October 7th included grilled trout, vegetable soup, and fresh fruit. The soup was made lovingly by Sergeant Mone, Ike's valet, who kept busy by preparing a few of the president's favorite dishes in the Dowd family kitchen. On October 9th, Dr. White returned to examine the patient and reported that while Ike's prognosis was favorable, he would need 5 more weeks in the hospital before he could be transferred to his home in Gettysburg. White thought it possible the president could be back to work in Washington by the 1st of January, when Congress was back in session. Eisenhower had survived the heart attack but could not function fully as chief executive. In principle, Nixon ought to have supervised the government while the president recovered, but Nixon later admitted that he was completely unprepared for the shocking news of the heart attack relayed to him in the early afternoon of September 24th by Haggerty. After putting down the receiver, Nixon sat in a stupor in an armchair in his Washington home. After a while, he called his close friend and confidant, William P. Rogers, the deputy attorney general, and asked him to come to his house. The two men sat together a while, talking about Nixon's next move. But with news of the president's illness now flooding the airwaves, reporters started to crowd Nixon's front lawn. Only then did Nixon make his first decision. He and Rogers fled out the back door, crossed his neighbor's lawn in darkness, and slipped into a waiting Pontiac driven by Rogers' wife. The vice president then went into seclusion at the Rogers home, staying out of public view until Sunday, when he attended church services with his family. Only then did he speak to reporters. For almost 24 hours after hearing about the heart attack, the president's constitutional successor refused even to be photographed by the press. Why was Nixon suddenly so publicity shy? Surely his role should have been to reassure the public right away about the continuity of government. Instead, he weighed the politics. Every move during this period, he calculated, had to be made with caution, for even the slightest misstep could be interpreted as an attempt to assume power. Thus, in a moment of grave national crisis, Nixon ran through the political costs to himself of any public statement. When he gave his first press conference, he nonchalantly declared that the Eisenhower team would carry on as usual. Any political implications of the president's illness, he said, were unworthy of consideration. Yet on Monday evening, Nixon held a four-hour strategy session with Len Hall, the Republican national chairman, to discuss precisely that subject. Adams, who returned from a fishing vacation in Scotland, sat in on the discussion and refused to speak. Nixon grasped why. Adams' sole loyalty was to Eisenhower. He would have no part in discussing a future without him. In fact, the senior members of the Eisenhower administration quickly moved to limit Nixon's authority. The vice president did not occupy center stage during the weeks that followed the heart attack. Sherman Adams did. It was Adams who, along with Attorney General Brownell, also hastily returned from a European vacation, decided that there was no need to turn power over to the vice president. The president was ill, but still alive and mentally alert. He needed time to convalesce, and the nation needed continuity. Adams and Brownell decided to develop a staff system to shield the president from any burden or worry during what would be a prolonged recovery. In any case, Adams viewed Nixon as far too inexperienced to run the government. The cabinet met on September 30th and, despite Nixon's initial resistance, decided that Adams would go to Denver on October 1st to take command of the president's affairs there and act as the sole official channel of information between Eisenhower and the world. Nixon stayed behind, and he did not even visit the president until October 9th, a day after Eisenhower and Secretary Dulles met in private conference. For the next 2 months, the Eisenhower administration was managed by a committee consisting of six men: Adams, Nixon, Brownell, Dulles, George Humphrey, and Jerry Persons. Hagerty was the official spokesman and orchestra conductor. Of these, Nixon was the least consequential. He chaired the NSC and cabinet meetings, as he had done occasionally during the first term. But he had no executive power or authority to speak for the administration. Meanwhile, Dulles controlled the State Department, Humphrey the Treasury, Brownell the Justice Department. Most important, Adams, seated at Ike's bedside, controlled access to the stricken president. Eisenhower gradually regained his stamina at Fitzsimmons Hospital. Daily announcements marked his progress, which was slow. On October 10th, the president sat in the sun in a wheelchair for half an hour. The following day, he met with Dulles for 25 minutes. But he did not sit upright in a chair until October 15th, the day after his 65th birthday. He stood upright for the first time on October 23rd, a month after the heart attack, and did not take unassisted steps until October 26th. And even then, he merely shuffled across his bedroom. He was, in fact, a seriously ill man. Yet his handlers carefully managed the flow of information to suggest steady improvement, and on October 25th, the president was wheeled out onto the sun deck next to his eighth-floor room, where the press was allowed to photograph him. He smiled broadly, looked a bit thinner, and wore deep red pajamas, a birthday gift from the White House press corps. Above the pocket, the words, "Much better, thanks," had been embroidered in gold thread. He stayed in Denver until November 11th, then flew to Washington. Arriving at National Airport to the ovation of a large crowd, he quipped that he was sorry his trip to Denver had been a little longer stay than we had planned. His limousine drove him to the White House through cheering throngs. He gingerly resumed a light workload but transferred his life to Gettysburg until the end of 1955, with occasional trips to Camp David. There, in the Catoctin Mountain Retreat, he met the National Security Council on November 21st and December 1st. The discussions were substantive. By December, he was meeting daily with advisors and cabinet officials. On the doctor's orders, he went to Key West, Florida, for the New Year holiday, and it was not until January 9th, 1956, that Eisenhower returned to the White House to resume his official duties. Almost 5 months from the time he had left the Capitol in mid-August, yearning for a break from the pressures of the presidency. With the president convalescing in the care of attentive doctors, all the talk in Washington turned to the horse race of 1956. A consensus quickly emerged among the insiders. The president was too ill to run again. And without Eisenhower, the Republicans faced a political catastrophe. The 1954 congressional elections had revealed that nationally, the GOP remained a minority party. It possessed no leader other than Eisenhower who could unite the country. In fact, the Republicans had no one who could even unite their party. The factional disputes between the old guard and the moderates had only been masked since 1952. All the men whose names attracted speculation had serious flaws. Nixon led the pack by virtue of his official position, but most Republican Party elders either did not like him or felt he could not beat Adlai Stevenson in a head-to-head contest, as polls showed. Earl Warren, now happily ensconced at the Supreme Court, steadfastly refused to be drawn into the mix. Senate Minority Leader William Noland inherited the mantle of Robert Taft, but had none of his dignity or intelligence, and was loathed by most Eisenhower loyalists, especially Nixon, with whom he had a lifelong rivalry. The president's brother Milton possessed a winning last name, but never showed the least interest in stepping into the political limelight, despite the president's constant prodding. Treasury Secretary Humphrey, an able public servant, was 6 months older than Eisenhower. Senator Everett Dirksen had little national standing. And so it went. Things looked so bad that some insiders resurrected the idea of a Thomas Dewey candidacy. In short, the GOP cupboard was bare. There was something almost Shakespearean about this political scene. The stricken leader lay hidden away in Denver or Gettysburg, screened from public view by a cloak of doctors, observing the junior officers of the party vying for position in his absence. He almost seemed to be enjoying his position. No one could pressure him now to run again. As his strength recovered, he mused frequently about whether to stay in politics or retire. In a late October letter to Sweet Hazlitt, he revealed that his decision to run hinged on the issue of a successor. "I am vitally concerned in seeing someone nominated who not only believes in the program I have been so earnestly laboring to have enacted into law, but who also has the best chance of election. This is the tough one." But no one came close to matching his political strength. He had no viable protege, and he knew it. When in late November Eisenhower summoned Len Hall to Gettysburg, the GOP chairman desperately hoped he might coax an answer out of the Sphinx of Abilene. But Eisenhower was not yet ready to tip his hand. "Len, you're looking at an old dodo," Eisenhower sighed, seeming discouraged. Leaving the president's side with no clear statement to give to the waiting reporters, Hall improvised. He put on a big smile and told the press that he was encouraged by the conversation and thought Eisenhower would indeed run for election. "Ike will run if he is able," Hall told reporters, although the president had said no such thing. But Hall went all in. Ike was looking well and was sharp as ever. "As far as I am concerned, there is no other candidate." Hall wanted to project an air of inevitability about the race, though Ike remained silent. In private, Ike brooded on the problem of running again. Haggerty's diary recounts an intense period of 4 days in December, when he and Ike discussed little else. Eisenhower said he was appalled by the low quality of Democratic aspirants Averell Harriman, Adlai Stevenson, and Estes Kefauver. But he admitted, "We have developed no one on our side within our political ranks who can be elected or run this country." The two men spent hours reviewing possible contenders before discarding every name. Haggerty asked Eisenhower point blank if he would run again. His reply echoed 1952. "I don't want to, but I may have to." The conversation with Dulles in early January yielded a similar result. As the president summarized the discussion in his diary, "The world political situation remained so dangerous, on the verge of an abyss, that however much he wanted to retire, he must try to carry on. If lesser men should take over, Individuals of less experience, lesser prestige than Foster and I have, he mused. What will happen? Eisenhower likely made the decision to run again over the New Year holiday, which he spent in Key West, surrounded by his intimate friends and family, including Bill Robinson, the Kentucky liquor entrepreneur Ellis Slater, the Mississippi Democrat and wisecracking pal George Allen, Al Grunther, Mamie, Milton, and his retinue. He returned to Washington on January 9th, and on January 13th, he held a quiet dinner for his most senior advisors and cabinet members, except, significantly, Nixon. I told Nixon that the dinner was to discuss Eisenhower's future, and, since you are going to be so much the object of conversation, it would be embarrassing to you to be present. What I really meant was that the dinner guests would likely say that Nixon certainly could not replace Eisenhower in 1956. Not surprisingly, his advisors, whose status depended upon Eisenhower remaining in the White House, all urged him to run again. Dulles was particularly effusive, declaring Eisenhower to be the only man in the world who could guide humanity through the tempestuous crises of the decade and avoid a possible nuclear war. Len Hall argued that Ike needed to secure his political legacy. He had begun to transform the Republican Party, but still had work to do. If you have 4 more years, I think you'll make the Republican Party the dominant party in the United States. Milton sat quietly, taking notes, until Eisenhower asked him to sum up. He had already made the case privately for early retirement and did so again, basing his argument mainly on health concerns. Ike's son John, who also urged Ike to step aside, later reflected, "I probably will never know exactly how Dad felt emotionally about a second term. Probably he was ambivalent." But the January dinner seemed to have the greatest single influence on him. If he did not run, the Democrats would take back the White House. Only he could save the party and the country from that dreaded fate. John nailed it. His colleagues were telling him what, by that time, he wanted to hear. As in 1952, Eisenhower chose to run because he had come to believe he was the best man for the job, and the consequences of his refusing would be catastrophic for the country. He had the kind of powerful ego that characterizes all men who attain the nation's highest office. The idea of standing aside as a rookie like Nixon went down to defeat against the Democrats tormented him. He had never been a quitter, and he was not going to let a weak heart stop him now. Of course he would run. Was there ever any doubt? On February 29th, when he felt he could not keep silent any longer, he announced in a garbled and rambling statement to a press conference that he had finally answered the great question on everyone's mind. "My answer will be positive. That is, affirmative." That evening, at 10 o'clock, he went on national television to explain his decision. After much prayerful consideration and long discussions with family, friends, and especially his doctors, he had decided to seek re-election. His health was good, he said, although he would do little barnstorming during the campaign. More important, his work was not yet done. He remained passionate, he said, about expanding economic freedom, building equal opportunity, and ensuring national security. He would fight on. Chapter 12. A Formidable Indifference. The Republican Party is the party of the future. Eisenhower's decision to run for re-election posed an awkward question. Would Nixon remain on the ticket in 1956? The answer was not obvious. While the president's popularity remained high throughout the heart attack crisis, his party and his countrymen fretted anxiously about the future without Eisenhower. Nixon seemed diminished by the whole affair. Instead of acting as a valuable second in command, Nixon had been shunted aside as Adams, Foster Dulles, and Hagerty steered the ship of state during Ike's convalescence. Nixon drew praise in the press for being a good team player during Eisenhower's illness, yet it also became clear that he had no serious role to play in the administration. Nixon was superfluous. Eisenhower, with his sixth sense for picking winners and losers, understood this. During his long recovery, he spent many hours wondering if Nixon could fill his shoes. His conclusion? Decidedly not. Nixon was able, loyal, hard-working, devoted, but he was not ready to be president. The only way he could hope to emerge in 1960 as a viable presidential candidate was by gaining greater experience in government. Eisenhower viewed the vice presidency as a ceremonial post, not a place to gain executive skills. Even after 4 years in the job, Ike knew Nixon trailed Adlai Stevenson in the Gallup poll in a hypothetical head-to-head match. Eisenhower thought Nixon needed a crash program to enhance his visibility and prestige. A top cabinet job like defense or commerce would serve as better preparation for a higher office than another 4 years of being lost in Eisenhower's shadow. And that is what Ike suggested to Nixon in a conversation in December 1955, the day after Christmas. The suggestion to step off the ticket and take a cabinet job seemed to Eisenhower a constructive one. But it came as a shattering blow to Nixon and triggered yet another of his famous crises. Nixon knew that a cabinet post would represent a demotion. Worse, it would mean Nixon had been dumped. Eisenhower asked him 5 or 6 times to join the cabinet. Each time, Nixon refused. If Eisenhower wanted him off the ticket, he should say so, and Nixon would step down. Eisenhower thought he was offering Nixon a chance to improve himself. Nixon considered Ike's advice a political cyanide capsule. While awaiting Nixon's decision in January and February 1956, Eisenhower mused about replacements. One man he considered was Frank Lausche, the Catholic and Democratic governor of Ohio, known for his independence and bipartisanship. Ike thought the GOP would benefit immensely from putting a Catholic on the ticket, but he told Len Hall that his first choice was Robert Anderson, a Texan and nominal Democrat who initially served as Ike's Secretary of the Navy and then as Deputy Secretary of Defense, propping up the increasingly unreliable and gaffe-prone Charlie Wilson. Anderson was a businessman, an administrator, a moderate, self-effacing, nonpartisan wise man, just the kind of technocrat Eisenhower wanted in government. Unbeknownst to Ike, he was also an alcoholic. In fact, Ike briefly discussed with Adams the idea of having two vice presidents, one to handle domestic policy and the other foreign matters. Men of substance who could handle the heavy burdens of government and bring to the president only the most crucial decisions. Ike did not have Nixon in mind for either role. In the early spring of 1956, while Eisenhower relaxed on George Humphrey's Georgia plantation, shooting quail and enjoying the luxurious surroundings with Jock Whitney, Bill Robinson, Bob Woodruff, and their families, Nixon endured a period of agonizing indecision. Even by the time of Ike's official announcement on the last day of February that he would run again, the two men still had not resolved Nixon's future. The press asked the president directly if he wanted Nixon as his running mate. Eisenhower simply said he would wait to see what the Republican convention would decide. While full of admiration for Nixon, he would say no more about it. The press predictably interpreted this evasive comment as a sign of disapproval. A week later, they peppered Eisenhower with more questions. The president replied testily that he had asked Nixon to chart out his own course and tell me what he would like to do. But Nixon refused to beg. The stalemate endured. In mid-March, the two men discussed the issue again. Nixon told Eisenhower that the decision to wait until the convention to announce his running mate had created some misconception in the minds of some people that there is some conflict between the president and himself. Further, he said that moving to the cabinet would suggest to the press that Nixon is afraid to run again, or the president is afraid to have him. Therefore, it is a way of kicking him upstairs, or downstairs. Ike replied that the decision was Nixon's to make, but continued to make his own preference clear. The president's concern is, according to the written summary of one conversation, where is Nixon going to be 4 years from now? What does 8 years in this job do for him? In the long run, he is thought of as the understudy to the star of the team, rather than being a halfback in his own right. Eisenhower kept repeating how much he liked Nixon, and that he had his best interests at heart. But Nixon said at least 3 times in this conversation that he would not move to the cabinet. I did not relent. In early April, he again urged Nixon to take a cabinet job, but did not order him to do so. Nixon again demurred, waiting for an offer to stay on the ticket that did not come. Privately, Eisenhower told RNC Chairman Len Hall that Nixon, while having done a fine job as vice president, was making a mistake in seeking to stay on the ticket. I think he would do better by taking a cabinet post. Even so, Eisenhower would not directly order Nixon off the ticket. Ike did not like confrontation and hated to deliver bad news. He hoped Nixon would interpret the offer of a cabinet job as a presidential command, but Nixon did not comply. On April 25th, 2 full months after Ike had announced his re-election bid, the matter came to a head. In his news conference, journalists asked Eisenhower if Nixon had made a decision yet about his own future, and Ike replied that Nixon hadn't reported back. This comment cleverly placed the onus for the delay on Nixon, and made it impossible for Nixon to remain aloof any longer. The next day, Nixon formally asked Eisenhower to be kept on the ticket. Eisenhower pretended to be delighted, but he then sent Nixon out to meet the press with Jim Haggerty by his side to inform the waiting reporters while Ike stayed out of sight, suggesting that more pressing business needed his attention. The whole affair would not matter much but for the insight it gives into Eisenhower's style. He could have ended the standoff simply by stating publicly that he wanted Nixon to remain his vice president. He never said this. Instead, he made Nixon sweat. The price of rejecting Ike's advice was public humiliation, which duly came and which Nixon never forgot or forgave. With good reason, Nixon concluded years later that Eisenhower was a far more complex and devious man than most people realized. Nixon was not alone in drawing this conclusion. Although Eisenhower appeared to the public as a rosy, optimistic, ebullient figure, a genial and avuncular man, those who watched him carefully never could quite understand him. 4 years ago this week, wrote the seasoned newsman James Reston in late May 1956, Dwight D. Eisenhower arrived in Washington from Paris to seek the presidency. The Capitol is still trying to figure him out. Reston mused about how Ike governed. Was he a leader or a mediator? Did he make tough decisions or avoid them? Had he merely substituted personality for policy? Other than optimism and pragmatism, what skills did Eisenhower possess that made him such a political phenomenon? Reston concluded simply that Ike looked good to most Americans because the previous 2 decades had been so troubled. After a generation of contention, of war, of depression, of acrimonious divisions in the nation, he was urged to enter the arena precisely because he was an attractive mediator. He had calmed the turbulent nation, poured soothing balm on its abrasions. His bid for re-election in 1956 rested mainly on a promise to deliver more of the same. Some commentators delivered a more cutting assessment. Richard Revere, the acerbic New Yorker columnist, described the Eisenhower administration as a non-event in the nation's history. It has left the country almost exactly as it found it, with nothing added and nothing taken away. Ike governed with reference to a pastiche of pieties and seemed content to subcontract his job to others. Eisenhower himself was lazy. The whole operational side of government has bored him, Revere asserted. No president since Calvin Coolidge, who was a devotee of the afternoon snooze, has relaxed more or taxed his energies less than Eisenhower. He preferred to be kept out of the loop. There is a great deal of which Eisenhower has never heard, and he has organized his office staff and his cabinet into a kind of conspiracy to perpetuate his unawareness. To be sure, he had steered the country away from war and proved able to restrain his hawkish lieutenants. Even so, the dirty work of politics diminished him. He had become merely a distressed, flustered, put-upon man. If Eisenhower possessed a certain sanity, a quality of decency and maturity that Americans respected and valued, his chief characteristic as president had been his coldness, what Revere called a formidable indifference. This theme of a president missing in action, a leader uninterested in leading, became the leitmotif of the Democratic Party's 1956 campaign. Governor Stevenson, trying to erase the memory of his Hamlet-like hesitations of 1952, had declared his candidacy in November 1955 with a hard-charging speech about the need to avoid confusing moderation with mediocrity. Following Eisenhower's prolonged absence from Washington, as he recovered from his heart attack, Stevenson declared that the presidency cannot be conducted on a part-time basis, nor should the president be allowed to forego a serious national campaign on account of fatigue or infirmity. According to Stevenson, Eisenhower's refusal to campaign vigorously seemed disdainful, more like the behavior of a monarch or a corporate CEO than a public servant. Stevenson made every effort to link Eisenhower with the do-nothing presidency of Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover. Republicans who had failed to use the powers of the presidency and chose simply to stand pat. He accused Ike of sleepwalking through 4 years of an inconsequential presidency. Even some on the right voiced a similar critique. In the pages of the new magazine National Review, William F. Buckley and L. Brent Bozell articulated conservatives' deep disappointment with the president's record. The armistice in Korea, the deal to partition Vietnam, the lack of support for Chiang Kai-shek, and the cheery embrace of Soviet leaders at the Geneva summit, achievements Eisenhower believed had helped the cause of global peace, all looked like appeasement to hardline conservatives. Worse, Eisenhower's actions on the home front, from appointing Earl Warren to the Supreme Court, to expanding the role of the federal government in civil rights, public housing, and social security while cutting the defense budget, amounted to a betrayal of the conservative principles Eisenhower had embraced as a candidate in 1952. Soon after Ike announced that he would run for a second term, Buckley cast a vote of no confidence. "What were the objectives of the Eisenhower program?" Buckley asked in a scathing National Review editorial. "It is hard to say." Buckley likened Ike to the housewife next door, who wishes only to get on with her chores, to like and to be liked, to be tranquil and serene. Ike's policy vision was undirected by principle, unchained to any coherent idea as to the nature of man and society, uncommitted to any estimate of the nature or potential of the enemy. The Eisenhower administration is always emitting a squid-like ink of moral justification, and then hastily darting away through the clouded waters. Eisenhower was self-righteous but hollow, doctrinaire in rhetoric but soft in action, strident in mouthing words like freedom and liberty but afraid to fight for them. And here for Buckley lay the genuine danger of Eisenhower. To resist the socialist tidal wave, Americans needed ideas, passions, and beliefs. Ike had given them only aimless mush-headedness. Eisenhower himself was mostly immune to these kinds of criticisms, but Buckley's critique laid the groundwork for a campaign to push the GOP further to the right once the age of Eisenhower had run its course. 2. Just as critics on both the left and the right were registering doubts about Eisenhower's competence and energy, the president suffered another health crisis. On June 7, 1956, Eisenhower attended a dinner at the Sheridan Park Hotel to honor the White House news photographers. He enjoyed the elaborate floor show and ate a bland dinner that had been approved beforehand by his personal physician, Howard Snyder. Soon after returning to the White House, Eisenhower went to bed. Around midnight, however, Mamie called Snyder at his home and reported that the president was having terrible stomach pain. Snyder, used to such calls, suggested that Mamie give Ike some milk of magnesia. But 20 minutes later, she called again and said the pain was worse. Snyder hurried to the president's bedside. Eisenhower was stricken with an attack of ileitis, the chronic inflammation of the lower portion of the small intestine. For many years, he had endured sharp pains in his lower abdomen, at times extremely painful and debilitating. Snyder had examined Eisenhower repeatedly, trying to find the precise source of the problem, but not until he administered a barium X-ray in May 1956 did he find a constriction in the lower ileum. The problem did not incapacitate the president, but Snyder knew it would flare up again. As he examined the president in the early hours of June 8th, Snyder realized that this was no mere attack of gas. Eisenhower began to vomit. His blood pressure was 160 over 90, and he was perspiring. The problem demanded immediate operative relief. At 1:30 in the afternoon, Snyder ordered an ambulance and had Eisenhower transferred to Walter Reed Hospital. Unfortunately, virtually all the senior medical staff at Walter Reed had left Washington. General Leonard Heaton, the commander of the hospital and its chief surgeon, was on vacation in West Virginia, where the state police tracked him down and put him on an airplane back to Washington. The team of doctors who gathered at Walter Reed were wary of conducting the operation Snyder recommended on a 65-year-old man who had suffered a heart attack only 9 months earlier. As Snyder wrote later, everyone hesitated to put a knife into his abdomen. In fact, 12 hours passed while the doctors deliberated. After more X-rays, they reached agreement that the problem was an acute obstruction of the terminal ileum. In the early morning of June 9th, after a lengthy debate, Heaton accepted the unenviable task of performing major surgery on a sitting president. At 2:25 a.m., the doctors gave Eisenhower general anesthesia. At 2:59, Heaton made the first incision, and for 2 hours he snipped away at Eisenhower's innards, searching for, then finding, and then cutting out the constricted portion of the ileum. It was for Heaton a familiar operation, one he had performed scores of times. But there could be no denying the tension in the room. At 5 o'clock in the morning, Heaton finished his work and deemed the operation a success. The surgery resolved the physical crisis, but inevitably triggered a political one. Above all, reporters wanted to know who had been in charge while the president was unconscious. The answer seemed to be, as usual, Sherman Adams. Spokesman Jim Haggerty casually told the press corps in the hours after the operation that no thought had been given to transferring presidential powers to the vice president. The 25th Amendment, clarifying the procedures for presidential succession, did not become law until 1967. The operation posed again the question of whether Eisenhower should go ahead with his plan to run for re-election. He spent 3 weeks in Walter Reed after the surgery, and his medical reports reveal a difficult recovery. His inflamed bowels caused him distress, and his wound briefly became infected. He stoically endured frequent enemas, one of milk and molasses, another of olive oil. He had diarrhea and did not eat solid food for a week. His weight dropped to 158 pounds, almost 20 pounds lighter than usual. 2 weeks after the operation, he continued to endure moderately severe anorectal pain and hemorrhoids. After 3 weeks, he moved to his home in Gettysburg to continue his recuperation. Eisenhower clearly could not endure an arduous national campaign for re-election. For a time, he wrote, he seriously doubted if I would ever feel like myself again, and was miserably uncomfortable. He found Gettysburg restful after the constant surveillance of Walter Reed, but not until July 14th could he boast of having walked all the way to the gate and back, a distance of a mile. He put on a brave face when a group of congressional leaders visited the farm on July 10th and reassured them that he had every intention of keeping his pledge to run for re-election. He told them, "I've had a rough ride, but if I was right on February 29th, I am now in much better condition." Brave talk. But he had been significantly slowed by his recent surgery. When he returned to Washington on July 16th, he looked frail and thin. According to Ann Whitman, his personal secretary, the president had regained some strength but showed signs of a great physical and psychological depression. And he would have trouble hiding this from the public. The Democrats made it clear Eisenhower's health and his absences from the White House would be a major issue in the election campaign. After all, in the 11 months since his September 1955 heart attack, Eisenhower had been incapacitated for 6 of them. With the Republican National Convention set to open on August 20th in San Francisco, it was natural that some might ask, could he carry on? 3. The issue of Eisenhower's strength and fortitude became urgent in 1956, not only because a presidential re-election campaign loomed, but because the country entered into a period of dramatic tumult over the politics of race. If ever there was a time for wise and active presidential leadership on civil rights, the mid-1950s was it. And yet Eisenhower seemed to many observers to have gone missing in action. By the start of 1956, the White South had developed a political strategy to oppose the Supreme Court ruling in Brown versus Board of Education. One influential activist who helped shape this strategy in defense of racial segregation was James J. Kilpatrick, the 35-year-old editor of the Richmond News-Leader in Virginia. A balding, stocky, humorless Catholic originally from Oklahoma, Kilpatrick used his editorial page to rally Southerners to fight the ruling by revivifying the doctrine of interposition. This warmed-over version of the nullification thesis conceived in the 1830s by the pro-slavery Senator John C. Calhoun of South Carolina held that the states could interpose themselves between the people and the federal government to block any tyrannical usurpation of power by Washington. The Brown decision, according to Kilpatrick and many other white Southerners, sought to rob the states of their right to educate children in a manner conducive to Southern tastes and values. The Constitution did not give to the federal government the duty to educate children. It left education to the states. This right must now be defended with massive resistance to federal demands for racial integration. In Kilpatrick's skilled hands, interposition became a way of hiding the ugliness of white supremacy in the legalistic appeal to states' rights. Kilpatrick's arguments found a warm welcome across the South. On February 1, 1956, Virginia's Senate and House of Delegates passed a resolution denouncing the illegal action of the U.S. Supreme Court in ordering desegregation of public schools. On the same day, 4 large crosses were set alight on the campus of the University of Alabama in protest of the court-ordered enrollment of Authorine Lucy, a black graduate student. South Carolina's legislature followed Virginia's lead, passing a resolution of interposition that railed against the illegal encroachment by the central government into the reserved powers of the states. Mississippi did the same on February 29th, as did Georgia on March 9th. Soon every state of the Confederacy had passed similar resolutions defying the Supreme Court. And the leading political figures of the South rose with one voice in the halls of the Capitol to denounce federal overreach and the specter of race mixing. On March 12th, Senator Walter George read the infamous Declaration of Constitutional Principles, or Southern Manifesto, on the floor of the Senate. 19 senators and 82 members of the House of Representatives appended their names to the shameful document. Distinguished legislators like Richard Russell of Georgia, Harry Byrd of Virginia, Russell Long of Louisiana, William Fulbright of Arkansas, and even the 1952 Democratic vice presidential nominee, John Sparkman of Alabama, all signed. The manifesto accused the Supreme Court of substituting naked power for established law, declared the Brown decision an abuse of judicial power, and insisted that the South be allowed to protect its habits, traditions, and way of life. The Supreme Court's action had triggered racial tumult in the South that was destroying the amicable relations between white and Negro races. The court had planted hatred and suspicion where there has been heretofore friendship and understanding. Mississippi Senator James Eastland lent his Delta-accented voice to the segregationist cause. A Democrat and cotton farmer from Sunflower County, Eastland had earned a reputation as a conspiracy-minded anti-communist who used his Internal Security Subcommittee to probe into politically suspect activities. He offered a simple explanation for the Brown decision. The Supreme Court had fallen victim to left-wing brainwashing. He criticized Eisenhower directly for expressing even tepid support of the court's decision and asserted that Ike himself would not send his own grandchildren to integrated schools. "Ike is like all interracial politicians," Eastland sneered. "He wants it for the other fellow." Eastland articulated the view, common among powerful white Southerners, that the race problem had been manufactured by outside troublemakers. "There is no discrimination in the South," he declared on NBC's Meet the Press. "There are social questions that we think we know more about than others do who don't have those social questions. Segregation is in the best interest of both races. Both races develop their own culture and develop better when they are separated." In March 1956, this passionate defender of Jim Crow segregation was elevated to the chairmanship of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Eisenhower, in his usual fashion, tried to pour oil on these troubled waters. In a press conference on March 14, he downplayed the nature of the constitutional challenge from the states. "No one in any responsible position anywhere has talked nullification," he declared disingenuously. He went on to stress that the Supreme Court had recognized the emotional dimension of the subject and had called only for gradual desegregation of schools. He hailed people who are ready to approach this thing with moderation. In a masterful example of double speak, Ike said that Americans must be patient without being complacent. While deploring extremists on either side, he said it seemed perfectly understandable for Southerners to take time to adjust their thinking to a new legal reality. He concluded in a matter-of-fact way that all he would do was uphold the Constitution of the United States, as if that might settle the issue. Hoping to avoid any personal role in the debate, Eisenhower turned to the nation's white church leaders in search of support. He met with his friend and advisor Billy Graham on March 20th and exchanged letters with Graham in the following days. Ike wanted ministers to talk up the need for progress in our race relations. He suggested to Graham that Southern pastors call for a few modest, concrete measures in order to fend off heavy-handed federal action. Putting black citizens on school boards and city and county commissions, getting blacks into graduate schools, and easing Jim Crow laws and public transportation, such simple steps would help moderate black demands and pose no threat to white authority. Could not church leaders emphasize the need for such actions? Graham promised to convene leaders of the major Southern denominations and urged them to speak out in favor of moderation, charity, compassion, and tolerance toward compliance with the Supreme Court. But Graham advised Eisenhower to stay away from the issue until after the November elections. "You have so wonderfully kept above the controversies that necessarily raged from time to time," he wrote. "It would be best to stay out of this bitter racial situation that is developing." Eisenhower was only too happy to take this advice. "Let's don't try to think of this as a tremendous fight that is going to separate Americans and get ourselves into a nasty mess," he told reporters on March 21st. For Eisenhower, civil rights politics should simply be avoided. As the 1956 presidential campaign approached, Ike adopted what his speechwriter Emmett Hughes called the most conservative caution toward the subject of civil rights. Although Max Rabe, the minorities officer in the White House, urged Chairman Adams to push Eisenhower on civil rights, the president remained wary. He did not think there was much to be gained politically by drawing attention to the Brown decision. On August 8th, just before a press conference, Hagerty advised Eisenhower that black voters in the North were likely to fall in line behind the Democrats anyway, and too much pressure on civil rights would alienate white Southerners. Ike agreed. When asked by reporters later that day if the GOP platform should expand